public hanging. Yes, sir, I know.
Welcome, everybody, to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest this first hour is former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. Just before last Christmas, the Bush White House finally called off the team that had been searching for the so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Here to help explain this situation is former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, a former Marine who was appointed to UNSCOM in 1991, and was chief of the inspectors until he resigned in 1998. Mr. Ritter opposed the invasion of Iraq, saying there was no evidence of a revived weapons of mass destruction program. He is now an independent consultant and columnist, has written the books Endgame and also War on Iraq, What Team Bush Does Not Want You to Know, and made a movie called Shifting Sands. And he's also a volunteer fireman. So welcome to the show, Mr. Ritter.
Well, thank you very much.
It's great to have you on. Now, we only have a few minutes before the first break here, three or four. So maybe in this first little segment, you can tell us a little bit about your career in the Marine Corps and how you became a weapons inspector.
Well, I was commissioned in the Marine Corps in 1984 when I graduated from college and became an intelligence officer. And in 1987, I was selected to go to the former Soviet Union as part of the weapons inspection teams that were implementing the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty signed by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, which got rid of an entire class of nuclear weapons. I did that job for a couple of years, and then in the summer of 1990 went back to the Marine Corps just in time for Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. And I served as an advisor to the Commandant of the Marine Corps for a couple of months, and then was sent to Saudi Arabia, where I participated in Operation Desert Storm as a ballistic missile analyst responsible for trying to prevent Iraqi Scud missiles from being launched against Israel. And I think the combined experiences of my time in the Soviet Union as a weapons inspector and my experience during the Gulf War looked like something that people in the United Nations wanted. By September of 1991, it was evident that the Iraqis were lying about their weapons of mass destruction and were hiding these from the inspectors. And the United Nations determined that they needed an intelligence capability to try and figure out how the Iraqis were hiding these weapons and where they were hiding them. And I was invited to come to the United Nations and head up the creation of this intelligence unit.
Who else were in the teams? What sort of different professions were involved in the inspections?
Well, when the inspections first started, the vast majority of the people were technical experts, provided by their countries, respective countries. When you go after chemical weapons, you need a chemist. You need a biologist for biological weapons, a nuclear physicist for nuclear weapons, and a rocket scientist to go after ballistic missiles. So you had an assortment of experts, but their expertise is only useful when you have your hands on the weaponry itself. When the Iraqis are hiding the weapons, these experts are no longer viable as inspectors. You now needed to bring in investigators, forensic examiners, etc., people who were experts at looking at a piece of terrain as though it were a crime scene, because that in effect is what it was. When Iraq chose to hide weapons, to tell lies about where these weapons were hidden, we had to bring in investigators who would then sift through the available data to determine what the truth was. And my responsibility was to come in and help lead these investigations. I'm not a chemist, a biologist, a nuclear physicist, or a rocket scientist. I'm an intelligence officer, and my job was to gather the data so that these experts could go back to Iraq and complete their mission.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, and we'll be right back.
Take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Yeah.
right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is former UN Weapons Inspector and independent journalist, Scott Ritter. Now, setting the stage here, in the summer of 1990, Iraq invades Kuwait, and the United Nations put sanctions on Iraq. And then that is followed by Operation Desert Storm, the first Gulf War, at the beginning of 1991. And then it was part of the terms of the surrender, or the terms of the ceasefire in that agreement, that the sanctions would be kept in place until Iraq was effectively disarmed. And that's where the guest, Scott Ritter, comes in. He was the head of the weapons inspection teams in charge of disarming Iraq. And you mentioned, sir, before the break, that they definitely were not making it easy for you to disarm them.
Right. Well, I need to correct the record on one thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I wasn't the head of the weapons inspectors. That responsibility was that of a Swedish diplomat named Rolf Ekéus. I was brought in to head up the intelligence unit inside the weapons inspectors, and then later went on to lead inspections in Iraq as a chief inspector. But, you know, there were a number of chief inspectors who, you know, every team that went in had an individual known as the chief inspector. So I don't want any of your listeners to get the impression that I'm somehow trying to promote myself after the fact. I was one of you know, many inspectors who were doing the job. I happen to have a pretty unique aspect of that work, but I wasn't alone in my job. Now, as I also think we need to backtrack a little bit more and put things in a proper perspective, because the chronology that you just went through would leave the impression that the United States was in line with the United Nations when it came to the disarmament of Iraq. But we can never forget that the intervening time between when sanctions were imposed on Iraq in August 1990 and Operation Desert Storm finished up in early March of 1991, that there was a domestic political dynamic taking place here in the United States. We had the President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, selling the war to the American people, trying to explain why it was we needed to confront Saddam Hussein. And he did so by likening Saddam Hussein, who, probably embarrassingly so, just a few months prior was named as a strategic ally of the United States. We suddenly had to explain to the American people why we were seeking military confrontation with somebody we called a good friend of America. And the president did so by likening Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler, called him the personification of evil, and said there must be a Nuremberg-like retribution exacted on Saddam. So even though the United Nations spoke of the liberation of Kuwait, that from a domestic political perspective here in the United States, the American people had been promised Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. So at the end of the first Gulf War, while we had liberated Kuwait, Saddam was still in power, and this presented a political problem to the president. And so it's not as though the international community was clamoring for the disarmament of Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction is a serious issue, but no one viewed Iraq as a global threat in the form of their weapons of mass destruction. Iraq did not constitute, you know, a threat to, you know, to the world's well-being. Iraq was a political problem for the United States, who used the United Nations as a vehicle to contain Saddam. Economic sanctions that were linked to the liberation of Kuwait no longer had a justification for being continued following Kuwait's liberation. The United States put forward a new justification, that is, weapons of mass destruction and need to disarm, not because we were concerned about weapons, but we were concerned about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. The CIA said that Saddam could only last 6 months, that the combination of economic catastrophe because of the sanctions, the military defeat, and the political embarrassment would cause somebody to come from within Iraq to eliminate Saddam. All we had to do as America was to keep him contained, keep the sanctions in place, keep the pressure on. And this is what the inspections were really about from the Americans' perspective, not the disarmament of Iraq, but the removal of Saddam Hussein. Weapons inspections were only useful to American policy insofar as they facilitated the notion of regime change. the United States never truly pursued aggressive disarmament. And this put weapons inspectors like myself in a very difficult position because we did our job in accordance with the mandate that the Security Council of the United Nations gave us. Remember, the United States sat on the Security Council. The United States voted for these resolutions. The United States, together with the rest of the world, said, you must disarm Iraq. And yet when we tried to disarm Iraq, especially in the early months, the Iraqis obstructed our work. They submitted false declarations. They lied. They threatened us. Now, one would think that if the disarmament resolutions, which were linked to a ceasefire, were being seriously implemented, that when Iraq obstructed the work of the inspectors, the United States and the Security Council would be seeking to hold Iraq accountable. And then in June and July of 1991, Iraq did just this. They denied having a nuclear weapons program. Weapons inspectors found the nuclear weapons program. They were shot at by Iraqis who refused to cooperate. One would think that this would be the green light for the resumption of military action to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. But it was the United States that prevented military action from being resumed because we didn't want another war with Iraq. All we wanted to do was keep Saddam contained and destabilized through economic sanctions until he collapsed from within. So the weapons inspectors were not only lied to by the Iraqis early on, but they had their hands tied behind their back by the United States and the Security Council for whom we're supposed to work. Because when the United States refused to hold Iraq accountable for telling lies and then sent the weapons inspectors back into Iraq, the burden of proof shifted away from the Iraqis onto the shoulders of the inspectors. The inspectors were told after the summer of 1991 that their job was to go into Iraq, not to disarm Iraq according to a declaration the Iraqis would provide, but to search for hidden weaponry. We began the search for the negative. We began to look for things we had no evidence of existing. This is a very different job than traditional disarmament.
Well, and it's the same sort of thing that they demanded of Hussein before the most recent war, which is prove a negative, show us what you don't have.
Well, right, but there's a big difference. I mean, look, one of the reasons why I spoke out against this war is that, you know, we need to understand that there was a period of time in 1991, 1992, where the Iraqis were lying, where the Iraqis failed to do that which they were obligated to do by international law, where they were holding on to prohibited weapons capability. And even though we can sit here and debate whether or not Iraq's WMD represented a threat to international security, the United Nations, under international law, declared that these weapons needed to be removed, and they mandated an inspection process to do this. And Iraq was obligated under the law to comply. And early on, Iraq failed to comply. But by 2002, we had a situation where the Iraqis had actually cooperated with the weapons inspectors over the course of several years. And while the weapons inspectors couldn't demonstrate a 100% verification of the complete disarmament of Iraq, they could document up to 95% verification of Iraq's disarmament. And the 5% that was unaccounted for, we had no information that it existed. The Iraqis declared that it had been destroyed, but they couldn't prove it to our satisfaction. Therefore, we were searching for evidence that demonstrated what the final disposition of these unaccounted for weapons were, but we had no evidence that these weapons existed. And you have the Bush administration saying, no, there's massive stockpiles, there's huge amounts of WMD. This simply wasn't true. And then the Bush administration also put the Iraqis in, you know, the ultimate rhetorical trap when they said Iraq must submit a new declaration to the inspectors. And if this declaration does not list all of the biological weapons that Iraq is holding, does not declare the biological weapons program, does not lead the inspectors to the biological weapons, if this isn't accomplished by this declaration, then the declaration is false. Of course, when the Iraqis submitted the declaration, they did not declare a biological weapons program. They did not list any weapons. They said everything had been destroyed. And the Iraqis were telling the truth, but the Bush administration had built up a rhetorical trap so that even in telling the truth, the Iraqis were condemned as liars. And, you know, ultimately, that's what we went to war in Iraq on this time, a big lie, not from the Iraqis, but from the Bush administration.
Okay, well, a couple of things here. First of all, you say, and I have been rereading your book, although it's been a few years since I read it the first time, but the book Endgame, you describe that, especially at the beginning, they were very uncooperative, the Iraqis, with the inspections. And you say eventually they began to cooperate. And my first question is, at what point did they begin to cooperate, where they said, okay, we'll just go ahead and fess up, here's the truth?
Well, the Iraqis went through several phases of cooperation. Let's understand that when we started the weapons inspection process in 1991, the government of Saddam Hussein had made a strategic decision to hold on to weapons of mass destruction capabilities. Now, you have the weapons themselves, you have the means to produce the weapons, and then you have the know-how, the documents, the blueprints, the designs, etc. And the first thing that the Iraqis, initially they tried to hold on to all three of them. They submitted a false declaration, they underdeclared their weaponry, they denied certain programs existed. Because of the tenacity and the effectiveness of the inspections, we compelled the Iraqis to admit having a nuclear weapons program and eventually admit that they were holding on to weapons. So the first thing the Iraqis gave up were the weapons. They destroyed a huge number of these unilaterally on their own, trying to get rid of the evidence of their lies in the same way that a drug dealer would flush drugs down the toilet in an effort to deny that he ever had drugs. The Iraqis blew up their weapons.
All right, Mr. Ritter, hold it right there. We got to go out to break, but we'll be right back to finish up with the steps of the cooperation. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com for all the archives. Stay tuned. In the second hour, we're going to be talking to FBI translator, whistleblower, Sibel Edmonds. Right now, we're talking with Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector. And we're talking about the different stages of Iraq's cooperation with the inspections. And you said stage one, very little cooperation until you finally caught them with their nuclear program. And then their cooperation developed some after that?
Well, it didn't develop. It was compelled. The Iraqis were confronted by the fact that they had been caught red-handed. And so they, you know, the first thing they try to do is deny that there was any wrongdoing. And this was the analogy I was using of a, you know, drug dealer flushing drugs down the toilet. They blew up their weapons and then they buried them in the desert and walked away as if and still maintaining the fiction that they didn't have these weapons, that they had told the truth. But the inspectors were like hound dogs. We sniffed out the evidence and we confronted the Iraqis with the fact that there was unaccounted for weapons. And the Iraqis were forced to admit that, yes, they had, you know, in effect, flush the weapons down the toilet. And now we had to go in and carefully reconstruct the what we call the material balance, finding out how many weapons they had bought, how many weapons they had produced, et cetera. So now the Iraqis start cooperating with us. Once they were forced to admit lying, they start cooperating, but only about the weapons. They were still lying about weapons production capability, and then we had to confront them with that lie. And by 1993, 1994, the Iraqis had to admit that, yes, they had lied about some basic elements of their production. But then the Iraqis were still holding on to the documents, the brain trust.
But then Hussein Kamel defected, right?
Well, Hussein Kamel defected in August of 1995. The irony is that we had actually compelled the Iraqis to come clean about everything except the documents by the time Hussein Kamel defected. The Iraqis admitted their nuclear program, admitted their biological weapons program, and pretty much told us the truth about what they had done in the manufacturing area. Now Hussein Kamel defects, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, who had ran these programs in the 1980s, and the Iraqis finally decided to get rid of everything, and they admitted holding on to documents, and they provided the documents. They took us to a cache where over a million pages of documents were stored, and these documents pretty much confirmed what the Iraqis had been telling us, that, in fact, that this was it. There was nothing more. There were no more programs. There were no more weapons. It was all accounted for. But our problem is, you know, once somebody lies to you, you can't accept at face value future statements. You need certain elements of verification. They have to prove that what they're saying is accurate. And so the Iraqis were laying out an immense body of technical data about their weapons programs. But as we dug into, for instance, the documents, they said they were at this chicken farm that was owned by Hussein Kamal. Well, as we investigated the chicken farm, and I ran this investigation, we found out that certain aspects of their story weren't adding up, not about the weapons of mass destruction or the technical aspects, but how the documents got to the chicken farm. Hussein Kamal had nothing to do with it, we found. The documents were protected by presidential security. And suddenly we uncover this entire shadow network of concealment experts who were working out of the president's palace, and they had been working back since 1991. And when we asked the Iraqis about these people, they denied it. So we as inspectors are presented with a quandary. On the one hand, from a technical side, about the weapons of mass destruction and disarmament, the Iraqis are telling the truth. But on the other hand, we find out that during the time when they were hiding things, they won't tell us how they hid them, who was hiding them, why they were hiding them, where they were hiding them. And this made us suspicious. So we started digging more. And this is where we come into the ultimate problem. Because we now know that the CIA acknowledges that Iraq had destroyed its WMD by 1991, that Iraq had basically stopped any weapons of mass destruction work by 1993. And yet the majority of the confrontations with the Iraqis took place from 1996 to 1998. It's clear these confrontations weren't about weapons of mass destruction because there were no weapons of mass destruction during that time. Why were the Iraqis obstructing the work of the inspectors? It's because the inspectors, in their effort to find out how the Iraqis hid these weapons in the 1991, were getting involved in programs related to the security of the president at the same time that the CIA was trying to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And unfortunately, my pager has just gone off. You mentioned in the preface that I'm a firefighter and the alarm has just gone off, so I have to go now.
Oh, no.
Hopefully we can pick up on this.
Yes, that is unfortunate. I have a couple of more pages worth of questions for you here, but I appreciate the fact that you have to go and perhaps save somebody's life. So,
okay.
Scott Ritter, UN Weapons Inspector, thank you very much. If possible, we can maybe do this again next week.
Absolutely. I apologize.
Okay, no problem. Okay. Thank you very much, sir.